Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening and welcome to An Adventure in History. We're so glad to be here tonight.
I am very glad to be here.
It's cooler.
It is cooler.
And less humid.
And not cooler like Elvis, but cooler because I've just returned from a week in Florida.
In August.
Yeah, I had no choice.
Oh my gosh.
It was the only time my mother has moved into a retirement house home. Mm-hmm. In Florida, because my father passed away 2 years ago, and the three children, her choices were Oregon, Kansas City, and Florida. And there's no like retirement home where you can stay in that place and move to assisted living at some point and memory care if you need
right.
that. Here in Astoria, there's places in Portland, but that's 2 hours away.
Right.
In Kansas City, maybe perhaps it didn't get quite that far, but my brother lives in Florida with three children, so there's four households within 10 minutes that can come and help.
Yeah.
Like, hey, take you to the doctor's appointment and things like that. So
they won out.
So Florida was just an obvious choice.
Yes. But Florida in August.
But I will maintain nobody wants to live in Florida.
Oh.
And humankind was not meant to live in that environment.
Oh my gosh.
So my sister briefly visited in Christmas, but my mother just like moved in like a month ago.
Yeah.
So we kind of knew we had to go back. And our schedules didn't jive to go at the same time to aid in like rental car and things like that until August.
Oh.
So I just visited Florida in August.
So you got all the bugs, all the humidity. It's like
didn't 80. See bugs.
Oh, nope. Well, they're there.
I didn't even see any like little lizards.
Oh, wow.
If I take in the morning walk with my mother after breakfast.
Oh, good for her.
Like, right after breakfast at 7 a.m.
Right.
She goes out and walks around the building. It takes her 6 minutes to walk the entire facility.
Sure.
And she said, well, if you join me on that walk, you would see them. And I'm like, it is too stinking hot for a
like
walk in Florida.
80
even
degrees,
at 7 a.m.
80% humidity, right?
I mean, it was about 86, 87.
A temperature wise.
Yes. Oh, and it was like walking, you open the door from any building, and it's just like walk, this the heat just hits you, like opening an oven.
I hear you. I lived there for 6 years.
But you speak fondly of Florida.
I do. I have great memories, and I moved away. And I don't visit in August.
But the thing that struck me, I have to give a shout out, where we were visiting, it all looks like to me.
Oh, yes.
It's all flat. It all looks like. Mm-hmm. And we were joking at some point. My sister was in the passenger seat. And she goes, well, when we're keep driving, then turn at the 7-Eleven. I was like, there's a 7-Eleven on every corner.
Right.
That's not helping me.
I know.
But the thing I will say about the driving in Florida, I like that they have turn lanes that you can do a U-turn.
Yes.
Like every block, there's plenty of them. So when you go past, because it all looks alike, and you realize, oh, I just went past where I needed to turn, you can just do a quick U-turn.
Yep.
So I did appreciate that.
But there's like three lanes too. So it's like mm-hmm. six lanes on a regular road.
Yes.
Right. It's not, that's not your freeway. Yeah. We don't even have six lanes in our freeways.
So the other thing that amused me is I'm a big fan of Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. I can quote it. Yep. I can give you episodes and all that. But there's an episode where Jerry and Elaine go and visit Florida.
Yep. To a nursing home, right?
Or to a retirement community.
Yeah.
But like every stereotype. So I find myself eating dinner at 4 o'clock and the dining room is packed.
Yep.
It's completely full.
Oh my goodness.
So, but the other key thing, I don't fly very often. I suspect you probably fly more than I do by a lot.
Yeah.
Portland Airport. This has never happened to me before. I'm going through whatever the gate is on the left instead of the one on the right.
Mm-hmm.
And you start doing the little, the Disneyland zigzaggy back and forth while you're in line. And I'm all prepared to take the laptop out and take my shoes off. And there's a section where it suddenly gets wide and they make two people at a time walk across this little open area and a TSA agent and a dog walk back and forth twice.
Oh.
And then I get to I show my ticket, I show my ID.
Yep.
And then they let you go through and now I'm supposed to put my stuff on the X-ray. And they're yelling, keep everything in your bags, keep everything in your bags. And I'm like, do I need to take my shoes off? Nope. Do I need to take my belt off? No. You've already been checked by the dog.
Oh, interesting.
I still had to go through the X-ray machine.
Right.
But I was amazed.
Yeah. So whatever they, that extra.
The dog, the magic dog in his nose.
There we go.
But the weird thing is I'm going through the zigzag. I'm occasionally smelling pot.
Oh, yeah.
It is Portland.
Shocking, yeah.
Now, I suspect because I didn't smell it all the time, it wasn't the guy in front of me.
Right.
That it was somebody in the zigzag that I every now and then am next to. But they make two people at a time walk for this dog. And I'm like, I don't know this guy next to me.
Right.
And what if he's the one smelling like pot?
I have a feeling the dog would know.
Probably.
I think.
Like which one of us he starts barking at or something.
How funny.
And there's no way you go by yourself. They want two people at a time, no matter.
Right. That makes sense.
But then I also thought, okay, pot's legal in, in Portland.
But you can't.
Is it legal to fly with?
It's not at PDX, though, because it's a federal facility. Yeah, so you can't have it there.
And then I'm thinking, is that even what they're smelling for? Is it drugs or is it?
Like, I don't think so.
Like explosives and weapons and things like that.
Probably.
Yeah. But it was an amazing experience. I want more of this. I want more of these dogs out there.
Right? They probably think they cost more than the machines.
I don't care. It was charming.
It was fast, right?
And the dog is working. And I'm like, way to go, you dog.
I like the airports now where all you have to do is show them your driver's license. And that's all you have to show them. You don't have to show them a ticket or anything. And PDX is one of them, right? You don't show your ticket when you go through security.
I did. I don't know if they needed it.
Nope, they don't.
No. I'm still an old guy that prints out the ticket,
they
too.
Ring your... I don't do that ever, Mac. they put it in or they... I don't know what they do. They scan it, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then your information comes up.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, they did scan my... They like put in like a credit card almost.
So, and they don't do that at all airports. At some airports, you have to still get out your paper.
Interesting.
Or mine's on my phone, which I could show you how to do that.
I don't want to know how to do that.
What if you lose the paper? That's the problem.
I make sure I don't. I'm organized.
There you go.
Okay, so quick travel question. Speaking of airplanes. Mm-hmm. Are you a chitty chatter with whoever's next to you? Do you make friends?
Nope. But I also travel with children.
Well, that's true.
But no, I usually don't. I like to read.
I pull out a book for that exact reason.
Yeah.
We're just traveling companions.
Yes.
And I do look around and I figure out like, okay, if we crash and we're forming a new civilization on a deserted island, who's going to be the leader? Who are we going to eat first? Who's my friends and everything else? But other than that, I don't make friends. I read my book.
I think about who's going to tilt their seat back. Is this person going to fall asleep and tilt their seat back? Yeah, that happened to my daughter. The seat got back and I was like, oh, thank goodness it's her not me. And she was appalled that the person would do it.
Oh.
And she's like, shouldn't I say something? I mean, I have no room. Like, I don't even know why they let people put their seats back.
It does seem odd.
It does. And it's like 2 inches. Like, really? I mean, is that really doing anything to help your sleep get any better?
That's why I don't bother. I'm like, what's the difference?
I don't either.
There's really no difference in my seat. So,
One thing, we flew recently too, and we're really going on a tangent. Hmm. We went on a brand new Southwest airplane.
Oh.
Brand new. It was 30 days old on the day that we flew it. So maybe not brand new, but I mean, that's pretty new for an airplane. And it was pretty impressive. I mean, it was prettier, and Carly kept saying how clean it was compared to the others. And
the others
aren't really dirty. They just they're not the same, right? Everything's like faded. And
I would have to see like a comparison, I think, to notice.
It was definitely noticed. We noticed it the minute we walked on the airplane. I mean, it was very different. So.
See, I don't know how new I would want to be on a plane. 30 days, okay, it's flown enough times, it's fine. But
well,
like the first week, I don't know.
Don't you think before they add passengers, they do some other
Well, probably.
Flights?
I don't think they take it out of the factory and right to the airport.
This is the first day. Yeah, they don't ever tell people this is the first one.
Our mileage is 0001.
See, maybe we were day 30, but the first one with passengers.
Yeah. That's
good. Be okay. So, should I go to my word?
Word of the day.
This is a good one.
Forgotten
so these
word.
Are lost words, historic words. And this one is early 20th century. And I'm going to use this in a sentence.
Okay.
Okay. We're going to start doing this. You might have to remind me. There are dew droppers in your home that will soon be leaving.
Oh, there are people that do drop in and see me.
Oh.
And then they stay too long.
Oh, there you go. Interesting.
And you want them to leave.
So I'm referring to your children. And this isn't entirely true either, because I know this is your children aren't.
Dewdroppers, okay.
An unemployed young adult who sleeps through the day.
Wow.
And your kids aren't unemployed.
And that's a lost word.
So I know.
You would think by that definition it was something in the last 10 years.
Dewdropper. An unemployed young adult who sleeps through the day. Which sounds dreamy.
I like my definition better.
Somebody that drops
do in. Drop in and see me, and then they do, and I didn't want them to, but now they're there.
Yeah, which could also be said for your children.
No, I wanted them there.
Oh, that's good.
It's time for them to leave.
Yes, there you go.
Okay, so the history highlights of the day, these things that happened tomorrow, August 14th. 1784, the Russians settle Alaska.
Ooh.
Kodiak Island, Grigory Shelikov, a Russian fur trader, founds Three Saints Bay, the first permanent Russian settlement in Alaska. Now, have you been to Alaska? Have we talked about this?
I haven't.
Oh.
I really want to go.
It's a good place to go. 1848, the Oregon Territory is created.
Ooh.
Prior to that, we didn't exist. There was nothing here.
Right.
No people, no fish, no trees. It was just a big open space, and then all those things were created. After we decided there's a territory here.
Yes. Thankfully, we're getting much better at recognizing our history.
But that is not necessarily
prior
true.
To that, right.
Yeah. 1848, that's not when it all began, but that is when officially the Oregon Territory is created.
Right.
1908, the first beauty contest is held. Where would you guess?
Ooh.
1908, it's not in the United States.
Oh. I have no idea.
Folkestone, England.
Okay, yeah, wouldn't have guessed that.
First beauty contest.
Interesting.
1937, the Appalachian Trail is formally completed, traversing 2,000 miles in 14 states, Georgia to Maine.
Oh.
And I probably talked about this, that we lived very close to the Appalachian Trail, and hikers would frequently come near our property, and we actually used to like leave a hose out, and sometimes some hiker would be using our hose.
Sure.
1945, Japan's surrender is made public.
Oh.
World War II. But our history highlight of the day, I think had the most impact, 1935, FDR signs the Social Security Act.
Oh, yes.
Prior to that, we didn't care. Right. You're out of money, too bad for you. Right. Should have saved.
Yeah.
And now there's a safety net.
Okay.
Social Security. I love it.
Yeah. And how did they fund it? I wonder, those first, I mean, they just take from the reserves, I guess.
Well, now they do, yeah.
Yeah.
But then I think that they, and there
like
was.
They started funding it then.
Yes.
Okay.
And, you know, people were working. So basically it was instantly whoever, you were taking money out of your check and it's going towards.
Got it.
And that's the problem.
Right.
Politically,
now.
That not enough people are working and more people are taking it. So, but not going to get into that. But just the idea of Social Security. Fantastic. It's wonderful. We care about each other.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah.
What'd I miss?
You didn't miss anything.
Oh, you look poised like you were ready to...
I did, and I'll bring it back if there's time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because our history
highlight,
of our highlights, the Russians.
Yep.
And this is back to like the beginning of this radio show. This was founded, this radio show, in 2010 to talk about the Astoria Bicentennial in 2011.
Yep.
And the Russians and the Russian-American Fur Company... is kind of local history.
That's true.
It ties in. So I thought we'd talk about the Russians are coming.
Okay.
So in the mid-18th century, as British colonists began steadily populating North America's eastern side seaboard, a burgeoning world power was working to establish settlements on the continent's distant northwest coast, Russia.
A little distant.
Ever since its 1721 victory in the Great Northern War established Russia as Europe's dominant military force and prompted a formal declaration that its Tsar, Peter the Great, was presiding over a full-fledged empire, Russia actively worked to expand its global footprint. To do that, Peter and his heirs recognized that they'd need to look eastward to the Pacific Ocean and beyond to what is now the Aleutian Islands and the Alaskan coast. The allure? Not only the chance to seize more land, but the opportunity to maintain Russian dominance of the lucrative fur trade.
Yep.
So there we go. That's the tie. The fur trade, which at its peak in Peter the Great's lifetime, accounted for more than 10% of the empire's total revenues.
Okay. So Russian explorers and trappers had been aware of the potential riches that lay eastward since the mid-16th century. But it wasn't until 1725 that Danish-born cartographer and navigator Vitus Bering, commissioned by the Russian crown, set out to explore the lands along the northern Pacific, long settled by indigenous people, and claim them for the empire. Bering demonstrated that Siberia reached much further east than anyone had believed, and that it was possible to navigate the Arctic waters to Russia's north and reach the Pacific. He embarked on a year-long exploration to map the Aleutian Islands and coastline of Alaska, a necessary first step toward occupation and colonization. The territory he discovered was immense, and the weather dreadful. Also something explorers agreed with down here.
Yes.
Bering proved that it was possible to reach Alaska and points further south and establish trading posts and settlements there. In fact, only a narrow channel separated the Siberian and Alaskan land masses. But while those straits were named for Bering, he didn't live to enjoy the honor. He died of scurvy in 1741 while marooned on an island.
I want to learn more about him because of that.
Yeah.
I didn't realize.
It does sound like the life of an explorer.
Well, right? Dying of scurvy on an island. That's terrible. So the North Pacific's icy, foggy, stormy weather didn't deter Russia's, and I'm not going to pronounce these names correctly. It's a Russian word, promyshkalniki, which means fur trade entrepreneurs. And I'm not going to say that word again. So even though this bad weather, it didn't prevent the fur trade entrepreneurs from funding Alaskan voyages after robust demand depleted Siberia's stock of sea otter pelts and other furs. More than 40 merchants sponsored new expeditions between 1740 and 1800, and trappers returned laden with the pelts of sea otters and fur seals. And again, Astoria is 1811.
Yeah.
So this is 1740 to 1800 right now we're talking about. In 1799, the Russian government appointed an official with the title correspondent to maintain oversight of company affairs, the first being Nikolai Rezanov. This role was soon expanded to a three-seat board of directors, with two elected by the stockholders and one appointed by the government. Additionally, the directors had to send reports of the company's activities directly to the Tsar. They also appointed a chief manager of the company, who was stationed in North America to directly administer the fort's trade stations and outposts.
These lucrative ventures boosted Russia's interest in establishing Alaskan bases to sustain its territorial claims and support fur hunting expeditions. Indeed, it was a notable Siberian merchant and fur trader named Grigory Ivanovich Shelikovov, who ultimately founded Russia's first permanent settlement in Alaska, Kodiak Island's Three Saints Bay, in 1784.
On this day, well, tomorrow.
Shelikov spelled out his colonial philosophy in a letter to one of his aides 2 years later, instructing the latter to subjugate indigenous populations who he described as, quote, willful and lazy. Every one of them must be told that people who are loyal and reliable will prosper under the rule of our empress, Catherine the Great, but that all rebels will be totally exterminated by her strong hand, he wrote. Shelikov had already demonstrated that philosophy when he pursued early resistors, Kodiak's Aleutic people, I may have pronounced that incorrectly too, to a remote outpost known as Awakuk or Refuge Rock. He slaughtered hundreds and seized more as hostages.
So yeah, between 1790 and 1818, permanent settlements were established and a thriving maritime trade was organized. Aleutic and Aleut men from the Kodiak and the Aleutian Islands were forcibly conscripted to work for the company for three-year periods because they were, quote, among the most sophisticated and effective sea otter hunters in the world. I like how that juxtaposes about, oh,
right.
They're lazy and they're...
But they're the only ones
that can do it, know how to do it well.
And being forced to do it.
During its initial years, the company had problems in maintaining a pool of skilled crewmen for its ships. The limited number of Russian men proficient in naval craft in the empire usually sought employment in the Imperial Russian Navy. The RAC, the Russian-American Company, had difficulty recruiting men for naval training, in part due to the continued practice of serfdom in the empire, which kept most peasants tied to the land. In 1802, the imperial government directed the Imperial Navy to send officers for employment in the Russian-American Company, with half of their pay to come from the company. The relationship between the Russian colonizers and indigenous populations stayed volatile. While local communities traded with Russian merchants, they also fiercely resisted Russian encroachment on their land and proselytizing by Orthodox missionaries. But while native Tlingit warriors destroyed several Russian outposts in 1802, the colonizers regained control following the Battle of Sitka 2 years later.
Shelikov, who returned to St. Petersburg to receive praise and honors from Catherine the Great, appointed Alexander Baranov to manage his new Alaskan trading ventures in his absence. First as Shelikov's representative and later as the first director of the Imperial Russian-American Company, de facto ruler of the new colony, Baranov relocated Russia's Alaskan base to a place later called or renamed Kodiak and established new settlements. Baranov was replaced in 1818 by an officer appointed by the Imperial Russian Navy. The position of chief manager was thereafter reserved for Imperial naval officers. But back to Baranov, he had a new, more expansive mission. Not only was he responsible for maintaining the lucrative fur trade, but for establishing Russian political and religious dominance in the region. He imported serfs from the Russian mainland in an effort to establish farms in Yukatak, build forts, open sawmills and tanneries, and began developing coal and iron ore reserves. Still, Alaska's Russian community struggled mightily to survive. Living conditions were dire, as another notable Alaskan adventurer, Nikolai Rezanov, chronicled on visiting today's Sitka. Baranov lives, quote, in some wooden yurt so damp inside that mold has to be removed every day, Rezanov wrote. Heavy rains make the place resemble a dripping sieve. Food insecurity was also a major problem. After Tlingit massacred the Yakutuk settlers, Alaskan colonists once more became almost entirely dependent on supplies from Siberia, which sometimes arrived spoiled and often didn't arrive at all. By the winter of 1805 and 1806, when Rezanov arrived in the colony on an inspection tour, he found his fellow Russians on the brink of starvation.
So 1805 or 1806, that's when Lewis and Clark are hanging out here. Ooh. So close. So speaking of so close and south of Alaska, Rezanov bought a ship from American merchants and set sail in search of provisions for his compatriots. He had a vested interest in the colony's survival and expansion. Not only was he an ardent Russian imperialist, but his first wife had been Grigory Shelikov's daughter, Anna, making him a shareholder in the new state enterprise. So when he headed south toward the Spanish settlements in California, he wasn't just looking for supplies, he was seeking out new opportunities. He returned triumphant, having successfully challenged the Spanish ban on trading with outsiders and swapped Russian-made tools for wheat and other foodstuffs. Rezanov had gone further than anyone anticipated. He had married the teenage daughter of the Spanish governor and received preliminary approval for an official trading relationship between San Francisco and other Spanish settlements and the Russian colony. So I'm curious, that's two wives.
Right.
I don't know. I'm assuming the first one had passed or he left her in Russia or something. Yeah. Rezanov urged the RAC to expand further still north of the Spanish settlements in the California region. He told his Russian colleagues he had encountered land then unclaimed and unsettled by other European powers. He declared it to be Russia's for the taking. Mm-hmm. While Rezanov died on his way back to St. Petersburg, Baranov heeded his advice. In 1812... he established Fort Ross in what is now Sonoma County as Russia's southernmost North American outpost.
Interesting. So not here, though.
Not here.
Yep. They had kept going.
Because 1812.
Right.
Astoria was already here.
Yep. The only attempt by the Russians to enforce their claim to the territory was the seizure of the U.S. brig Pearl in 1822 by the Russian sloop Apollon. The Pearl, a vessel of the maritime fur trade, was sailing from Boston, Massachusetts to New Archangel, is that correct?
Yep.
Sitka. When the U.S. government protested, the Russians released the vessel and paid compensation. Due to treaty violations in 1833 with the British by the company's governor, Baron Ferdinand von Wrangel, the Russians later leased the southeastern sector of what is now the Alaska Panhandle to the Hudson's Bay Company in 1838 as part of a damages settlement. The border established by Russia was challenged by both Great Britain and the United States, which ultimately resulted in the Russo-American Treaty of 1824 and the Russo-British Treaty of 1825. Russian merchants were excluded from the port and its valuable markets, something the RAC endeavored to change.
So the word you just didn't want to try to pronounce, and I'm not going to pronounce it correctly either, is Gungzhou, and that's China.
Oh.
So part of the fur trade, the fur is heading towards China, and then we're getting spice and silk and tea.
Okay.
So that's one of the reasons that Astor wanted to establish something here. It's easier to run back and forth to China from here than it is from the Atlantic.
So they were excluded from.
Yep.
Okay. The company funded the circumnavigation that lasted from 1803 to 1806 with the goals of expanding Russian navigational knowledge, supplying the RAC stations, and opening commercial relations with the Qing Empire. While the expedition did sell its wares at the Chinese port, no noticeable progress towards securing Russian trading rights was made during the next half century. Due to the closed Chinese ports, the RAC had to ship its furs to the Russian port of Okhotsk. From there, caravans typically took more than a year to reach Ion, Erkstooks, and the Siberian Route. The majority of the pelts were traded in Kiaka, where Chinese trade goods, principally cotton, porcelain, and tea, were traded. Fort Elizabeth was built in Hawaii by Georg Anton Schaefer, an agent of the RAC. His actions to attempt to overthrow the Kingdom of Hawaii is known as the Schaefer Affair.
There's a whole good story there, too.
Ooh,
see, we don't think of the Russians being all over this whole area.
I mean,
they're down in California. They're just north of here.
Right.
They're in Hawaii. I mean, they're trying just as much as Astor and the Hudson's Bay Company, or at the time,
right.
The Pacific, the Northwest Fur Company, rather. So they're all over the place. But over the course of the RAC's first decade of enterprise, its officials became increasingly concerned about American ships trading in adjacent coastal regions, especially their sale of firearms to the natives.
Sure.
Throughout 1808 to 1810, imperial officials appealed to the United States government to ban this trade. The American government took no action to satisfy Russian concerns. Discussions were held with American ambassador John Quincy Adams in 1810 to determine the southern limits of the Russians' claimed land. Government agents of the Russian Empire claimed the whole coast of America on the Pacific and the adjacent islands from Bering Strait southward toward the beyond the mouth of the Columbia River. The pronouncement stalled attempts at settling a southern border of Russian America for over a decade. American fur trader John Jacob Astor sent a ship in 1810 to present-day Alaska with the intention of supplying New Archangel. The supplies were welcomed by Baranoff, and he hired the ship to transport furs to Guangzhou, because an American ship could go. Upon learning of the pressing issue of American sales of firearms, Astor conceived of plans beneficial to both his American Fur Company and the RAC. In return for a monopoly to supply Russian stations through his subsidiary Pacific Fur Company, the ones that were here, and the right to transport RAC furs to the Qing Empire, Astor promised to refrain from selling firearms to Alaskan natives. The Russian minister to the United States, Count Fyodor Pailin, was informed of the proposal. He contacted the imperial government, noting that the deal would likely be more effective at ending the firearm sales than through diplomatic channels with the United States. Astor's son-in-law, Adrian B. Benton, traveled to St. Petersburg in 1811 to negotiate with company and government officials.
The proposed agreement was favorably received by the board of directors outside one contentious clause. Astor requested to be allowed to transport a minor amount of furs into Russia import-free, a benefit which only the RAC had enjoyed. Shareholders of the company, such as the minister of both the foreign and commercial offices, Count Nikolai Rumyantsev, expressed opposition to this provision. He believed that Astor had arranged all the negotiations to secure this trading right. Eventually, the Americans dropped the provision, and on the 2nd of May, 1812, the parties signed a four-year agreement. The two companies agreed to cease trading with the other merchants and prevent the trading operations on the coast by their competitors. But the onset of the War of 1812 between Great Britain and the United States and the capture of Astoria by the Northwest Company of Canada ended Astor's operations on the Pacific coast.
See, that's what we always talk about, is that he was talking to the Russians, hoping to keep the British off the coast, basically.
Yeah.
And this was all part of the negotiations right there.
Oh.
And of course, it didn't work out. And they end up selling us Alaska because they can't feed everybody there. The natives don't want them there. And the fur trade starts to peter out.
Yeah. Oh, so interesting.
The Russians right
the
here.
The Russians are
all
here.
Around us.
They're here. That's a good one.
All right.
Good lesson today.
Well, thanks for listening. Go make some history, and don't look up all those names and tell us how badly we mispronounce them.
I apologize.
We'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.